What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
The U.S. and Taiwan set the table for formal trade talks, plus what recent attacks on Russian targets in Crimea could mean for the war in Ukraine.
Now it feels to Ukrainians that they're able to take the initiative to actually damage the Russians in places where they don't expect that.
And could hydrogen airplanes be the future of aviation? It's Thursday, August 18th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The U.S. has announced that it and Taiwan will start negotiations on a bilateral trade and investment initiative this fall. Journal Deputy China Bureau Chief Josh Chin in Taipei says the announcement comes amid tension between the U.S. and China over Taiwan, and as the U.S. hopes to counter Chinese influence across the Asia-Pacific.
The trick for the U.S. is that Taiwan's economy is really heavily reliant on trade with China. So a bilateral trade deal with the U.S. would help reduce that reliance. In general, the U.S. has faced a bunch of criticism that it's putting too much emphasis on security relationships in the Asia-Pacific, while China has gone around and made itself economically indispensable to most of the countries in the region. And so recently it's been trying to address that.
The Chinese embassy in Washington didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. However, an embassy spokesman was critical of official interactions with Taiwan when the plans to strengthen U.S.-Taiwan economic ties were first announced in June. A U.S. federal appeals court has ruled that lawsuits by the state of Delaware and the city of Hoboken, New Jersey, seeking compensation from oil companies such as Exxon, Chevron, and Shell for the impacts of climate change should be decided in state, not federal courts. Oil companies have denied liability in the cases and sought to resolve the disputes in federal courts. But state and local governments have successfully argued their cases should be fought at the state level, bringing some of them closer to trial. The U.S. Supreme Court could still weigh in on the matter of where the latest cases should be decided. We are exclusively reporting that Amazon is on the hunt for a senior movie studio executive to helm its growing entertainment division and is turning to rivals for a chance to poach an experienced Hollywood player. Amazon executives have spent billions of dollars in the past year hoping to augment its Prime service by using A-list stars to lure subscribers. To date, Amazon has invested significantly in its film operations to scattered success and recently expanded into programming designed to have broader appeal. And American roads have had their deadliest first quarter in 20 years, according to new estimates from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The regulator estimated that more than 9,500 people died in motor vehicle crashes between January and March, up 7% from the same period a year before. Traffic deaths have increased in the past several years because of more drivers speeding, driving under the influence, or not wearing seatbelts during the COVID-19 pandemic. Earlier this month, the British-American aviation startup ZeroAvia announced an investment by American Airlines that could see the carrier potentially order up to 100 of its hydrogen electric engines. That news sent hydrogen hype to fresh highs, but what's the chance any of us will really be flying aboard a plane powered by hydrogen instead of jet fuel anytime soon? WSJ Heard on the Street columnist John Sindreo joins us now to look at the future of hydrogen-powered aviation. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing okay. So explain for us this bit of unfamiliar technology. What is a hydrogen engine, and how does it differ from what planes typically operate off of?
Well, yeah, this is the interesting question, because actually we all talk about hydrogen planes, but this is a very ambiguous term because it actually refers to at least two different technologies, and each of them has their own issues. when we're talking about this recent investment, what we're really talking about is ZeroAvia basically working on a propulsion system that works like a hydrogen car, that works with this technology that is called hydrogen fuel cells, which basically is a bit like a battery. So it's actually an electric vehicle. It's just that you feed it a hydrogen. This is a bit different from the types of hydrogen planes that have been tested in the past. Those are pure hydrogen planes, which means that they basically fly on a conventional engine. And instead of feeding it jet fuel, you feed it hydrogen and you burn it. So in a way, it's simpler, but it also has more issues because, for example, it is less efficient. So it generates more water vapor and it also generates other non-carbon gases that can be dangerous for the environment, even though we don't know how much, such as nitrogen oxides. Fuel cell technology is showing a lot of promise, but it is heavy. So it is hard to scale beyond regional flights. At that point, a lot of experts believe we will need to go back to burning hydrogen.
And so, John, what is the outlook then for these engines in the aviation industry? Could we see these used on planes other than just sort of short-haul flights?
I think fuel cells are promising for like regional flights. To go beyond that, you could do combustion. Airbus believes in it for 2035. The issue is that to go beyond that, it doesn't really matter what technology you use, because the issue with hydrogen is that it is very energy efficient, but in terms of volume, it is very inefficient. It occupies a lot more space than jet fuel, which means that as long as you have to do a short flight, you can kind of work around that. But once you need more fuel on a plane, it starts becoming impossible to put it there unless you redesign the plane completely. And that might not be something that we can do in the next 2 decades.
That was Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street columnist John Sindreo. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a pair of attacks in Russian-occupied Crimea are rattling Moscow's grip on the peninsula. We'll consider what recent Ukrainian strikes could tell us about Kyiv's strategy and capabilities after the break.
You're a growing business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Ukrainian forces surrendered Crimea to Russia's military in 2014 with barely a fight. But 8 years later, could explosions at Russian military facilities on the peninsula in the past week and a half signal that Crimea is back in play as Kyiv goes to new lengths to degrade Moscow's forces? Wall Street Journal European security correspondent James Marson joins us now from Brussels with a look at that and other questions. James, thanks for being with us.
Always glad to join you.
So, James, share with us what you can about these most recent attacks in Crimea.
So there have been a couple of attacks in the last week and a half. And in the case of the first attack, which was on Tuesday, the 9th of August, it was an airfield called the Saki airfield in Crimea, where the Russians have a whole bunch of warplanes. To begin with, the Russians said, nothing to see here. We found out from a senior Ukrainian official that Ukrainians were behind this, although officially Ukraine didn't say they were behind it. They were playing it coyly, publicly. Then a week later, on Tuesday this week, so this particular attack happened at an ammunition depot in northern Crimea. And this was exploding ammunition that then damaged power lines. It damaged rail tracks next to the ammunition depot. This time the Russians said this was sabotage. So it was the first time the Russians acknowledged that there was a large Ukrainian attack. And again, the Ukrainians mostly mocked the Russians over this, but they didn't really officially, publicly take credit for it. But again, in private, we received confirmation that this was actually a Ukrainian sabotage group that carried out this attack.
Not a giant sample size we're working with here, but I wonder if we can draw some lessons from these attacks nonetheless.
Absolutely. What they show us is actually not that Ukraine is gunning for Crimea at this stage of the war. Ukraine has said that it does want to retake Crimea, but at this stage, its goals are a little bit narrower. Russia occupied the south of Ukraine at the very beginning of the war, in the very early days, late February, early March. But Ukraine has been mounting a counteroffensive against Russia and forces in those territories in recent weeks. And the way that they're doing this is by using advanced American weapons to target high-value targets. So the idea is that Ukraine does not have the armor or the manpower to take Russians on head-on. As one Ukrainian presidential advisor put it to me, we don't want to go fist on fist against the Russians, but we want to degrade their forces so that we can reduce their ability to wage war and then squeeze them out. And so these two attacks in Crimea fit into that pattern because they've hit the planes. So some of the planes that were being used for reconnaissance or ground attacks in southern Ukraine, and they've hit an ammunition dump that was next to a rail track, which was obviously being used to supply weapons and ammunition up to forces which are operating in the south.
James, what have these strikes meant for Ukraine?
Well, for Ukraine, this is obviously a big morale boost. 8 years ago, the Russians took over Crimea with barely a shot fired. So this has been very emotional for people reconnecting with that territory in a way. But also it's been important for this stage of the war when the Russians have been on the front foot for a while, which has obviously been very painful for the Ukrainians. They've taken losses and they've lost territory. But now it feels to Ukrainians that they're able to take the initiative. So using these American systems, by having sabotage groups that are able to operate in Crimea, they feel like we're able to take the initiative and we're able to actually damage the Russians in places where they don't expect that.
And turning to the Russian side, what is the significance for them of these attacks and what has Moscow's reaction been?
So initially, with the attack on the airbase just over a week ago, the Russians played it down. With the attack on Tuesday, that was the first time that the Russians have admitted that the Ukrainians have mounted some kind of large-scale attack on the peninsula. So for the Russians, this was a shock. Because since 2014, they've invested a lot of money on the peninsula. They've built a bridge from mainland Russia, a rail and road bridge. And also Putin's whole messaging around the peninsula has been that this is Russia's forever. And it's never going back to Ukraine. And also the messaging around this war has been that, well, it's something that's happening on Ukrainian territory. But this is bringing the war to a territory that Russia considers its own. So it's bringing the war home to Russians in a way that's surprising for them. And you've obviously seen a lot of consternation, I think, among the Russian elite, among Russian propagandists who said, how can this be? We need to strike back. We must punish the Ukrainians. They've crossed red lines. But then the question arises, well, how? Russia has already launched a full-scale war against Ukraine, so what more could they possibly do? So do these two attacks taken individually hugely affect Russia's warfighting capabilities? Perhaps not, but they're part of a pattern. They're part of a much larger series of attacks, which taken as a whole are going to severely dent Russia's ability to fight the war, particularly in the south. And the biggest pressure point for the Russians at the minute is around the city called Kherson, which is a regional capital in the south of Ukraine. Now, it lies on the west bank of the Dnipro River, and the Ukrainian strategy appears to be to isolate the Russian forces there, starve them of ammunition, starve them of being supplied, and then force them to retreat back across the river and thus take the city back. Whether or not that works, not clear, but what they've done in Crimea is part of that strategy.
James Marson is the Wall Street Journal's European security correspondent based in Brussels. James, thanks so much for the time.
Pleasure.
And finally, between best before dates, best by dates, and sell by dates, food labels that are meant to communicate helpful information on freshness can quickly get confusing. Now, some grocers in the United Kingdom are abandoning those labels, instead relying on workers to scan codes and choose what to keep on shelves, and encouraging shoppers to judge freshness themselves. However, WSJ reporter Katie Dayton says that simplifying the system could introduce its own set of issues.
So the supermarkets themselves are saying this is all purely a move that is a good thing to do. However, some consultants I've spoken to said, well, there is pretty clear bottom line, which is that they're not wasting as much food and they're not losing sales. However, some people think that this might backfire and that without the best before date, users are going to be a little bit more cautious with where they buy from because they want the freshest food that there is. And without that best before date, you're losing information about how fresh an item is.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We will be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.